This is a joint work with another student. I'm going to talk about free analysis and large independent sets in the powers of complete graphs. I'd like to start my talk with two quotes, like three quotes. Both Newton and Lovaas invite us to find the relation between different branches of math. And the third one is a special one. So things have changed in the past two decades. In the past two decades, Fourier analysis has been shown to be very useful in the study of combinatorial structures. I just listed some branches of mathematics with combinatorial structures that Fourier analysis has been shown to be very useful in study of them. Like additive number theory, many interesting conjectures have been solved in additive number theory by Fourier analysis techniques, or study of Boolean functions, or discrete geometry. But not very much is done to graph theory. Okay, I'll talk about that more. So, I'm interested in the direct product of graphs, or categorical product of graphs. So, the direct product of two graphs, G and H, is I denote it by G times H, and it's a graph on the Cartesian products of the vertices of two graphs, and there is an edge between G1, H1, and G2, H2 if G1 is adjacent to G2 in G, and H1 is adjacent to H2 in H. So if they should be adjacent coordinate-wise. So here is an example. Just we want to multiply the two complete graphs and two vertices, and the product will be this graph, because here A is adjacent to B and C is adjacent to D, so I have this edge, and also here A is adjacent to B and C is adjacent to D. And for example, I don't have this edge because D is not adjacent to D in that graph. So, more specifically, I'm interested in the direct product of complete graphs. I label the vertices of the complete graph on R vertices by numbers from 0 to R minus 1, and I define the graph G as the product of N complete graphs on R vertices. Then what are the edges? Each edge is a N tuple because we have n copies of complete graph, so each edge is an n tuple of integers. Each one is some number between 0 and r minus 1, each vertex. So for these two vertices are adjacent if x1 is adjacent to y1, and x1 is adjacent to y1 if they are different, like the previous example. So two vertices are adjacent if they are different in every coordinate. X1 is different to Y1, X2 is different to Y2, and Xn and Yn. So we want to study the independent sets. Here, this graph has a very nice independent set. Just fix one coordinate by a number. So I put J here, and all other coordinates are free. I can put any number there. This is an independent set because, so here is the formal definition, Xi is equal to J, and others are free. So here, this is an independent set because every two vertices are in this set are not adjacent because they share this coordinate, so they are not different. They don't have different coordinates. So this is an independent set. So what is the size of this independent set? For every coordinate, we have R choices except this one. So the size is r to the n minus 1. So the size is r to the n minus 1, and the number of vertices of G is r to the n, so we have this relation. Many years ago, Greenwell and Lovaas proved that these are the only maximum independent sets in this graph. So when r is greater than 2, this is not true for r equal to 2. So this classifies all maximum independent sets, and they are all very nice. They all have very nice structures. But what can we say if we are not looking for a maximum independent set, but an independent set with large number of vertices, something that's close to being maximum? So more formally, what can we say if we have this relation instead of that one? If we have the size of I over the size of G is 1 minus epsilon over R instead of 1 over R. Recently, Alon Diner, Frigat, and Sudeko proved that there is a function of R, MR, such that for every such independent set, we can find a maximum independent set such that their symmetric difference is small. It's less than MR times epsilon over R. So, roughly speaking, this means that for every independent set whose size is close to maximum, we can find a maximum independent set that almost covers this set, almost approximated. Okay. So here, when epsilon is very small, we will have a very small number in here. So the fraction will be small, the difference will be small. So this is very good when R is constant, because MR is a constant, and by choosing epsilon to be very small, we'll get a very good bound. But if you look at the proof in there, you can show we can find examples such that we can show that the proof cannot imply something better than this. The proof requires that MR must be greater than C times R to the 4. So this is not very good when R is not constant. Like when R is equal to N, when we have KN to the N, this is not a very good bound. So in fact, to obtain any non-trivial bound, we need this, because we have a trivial bound here. We can replace this by 2 over R, because the size of each one is, the fraction for each one is 1 over R. So if we have 2 here, it's a trivial bound, like for every two independent sets. So to obtain any non-trivial bound from their results, we require this condition. What we did is we improved this theorem to this. Okay, so we replace M of R by 40. But we add some conditions there. R is greater than 20 and epsilon is smaller than 10 to the minus 8. They hope you forgive us for those conditions, because for R less than 20, their theorem gives a constant there. MR is a constant. And when epsilon is greater than 10 to the minus 8, we have this trivial bound again by the same argument. So we show that we can replace that MR by a constant. But to obtain 40, we need those conditions. So the proof needs Fourier analysis. Just overview some basic things. So we think of the vertices of G as ZR to the N, the groups that the abelian groups that are to the N. Then for every two functions from the vertices of G to complex numbers, we define their inner product as the natural way, 1 over G times the sum over all vertices Fx and conjugate of Gx. So it is known that the characters of that group, they have this property, they're orthonormal for every two vertices, two different y and j, z, we have the inner product are 0, and when they are equal, the inner product is 1. And also we need this last one, that u y of x is only a function of those values, those coordinates, such that y I is not 0 there. So for every coordinate that yi is 0 there, it ignores the value of xi. And so the Fourier expansion is this function. For every function, we can expand it by these bases. So every function fx is a sum of y all elements of the group and this functions u, y of x, and f hat y is just a number, a complex number. It does not depend on ui. These are the Fourier coefficients, and this is the Fourier expansion of every function. So now that we have the Fourier expansion, okay, so we can get the first trivial theorem, Parseval's equation. So if you multiply this function by itself, take the inner product of this function by itself, you see that for different values of uy, the product will be zero, so they will cancel out. And for the other values, this will be one when you take the product of uy and uy, and this will be f hat y squared. So we get that equation above. That's the Parseval. So the inner product is the sum of the squares of the Fourier coefficients. And by definition of inner product, we have this, because this is conjugate of every, if you multiply f by conjugate of f, you get absolute value of f squared, and that's the second norm of f by definition. Okay, so now we have the tools from Fourier analysis. So we want to study the independent set. We take the characteristic function of the independent set. That's one when x is in the independent set, and zero is when it's not. I use that notation, characteristic function of that statement. So when x is in the independent set, f of x is one, otherwise it's zero. So by f is a real function and only takes one and zero values. Then what is the second norm by that formula? F is only 1 when x is in the independent set. So that sum will be the cardinality of I, that sum. So I get this. The cardinality of I over cardinality of G is that the sum of the Fourier coefficients. So I define the size of every element as the number of non-zero coordinates in that. Alan Dinier, Frigat, and Sudako in that paper that I mentioned before, they proved that in that sum, in the Fourier, in this sum, the sum of the values on the values of y that has size more than 1, it's very small. So if you ignore them, you won't lose very much. Okay, so this is very nice. So we can only focus on the values of y that has size less than or equal to 1. So we chop up that part of the Fourier expansion, and we only keep the size, the Fourier expansion on the values of y such that the size is less than or equal to y. And these y's, they only have one, at most one non-zero coordinate, so they are very simple. And so what is this sum? It has one. When size of y is equal to zero, then it's zero. It doesn't have any non-zero coordinate. So we have f hat of zero. And the other ones, I partition them by the non-zero coordinate. So gi is those that have the non-zero coordinate exactly at the ith coordinate. So simply, this sum is the sum of g1 plus g2 to gn. And each one has non-zero coordinate at the ith coordinate. So without loss of generality, we assume that we have this relation. G1 is the one that has the largest weight, then G2, G3, and Gn. So we hope to show that, we want to show that we can, except this one, the other ones are very small. The sum of the other ones are very small, so we can ignore them like the other ones that we ignore them from that equation. So our goal is to show that if you take this sum from 2 to the n, it's very small. It's less than 8 epsilon over r. So I'll show you that this will imply that f is close to f hat 0 plus g1. So we can approximate f by this very simple function. So why that's useful? Because the total second norm of F, second norm squared of F, we saw that it's the sum of the squared of Fourier coefficients, and if you write that it's this, you have F has 0, the first Fourier coefficient, then those have one non-zero coordinate, and the rest is those have more than one non-zero Fourier coefficient. And if you take these two first ones to the left hand, then you will get this one. F minus these two is the sum of the others. These from i from 2 to n and this one. And we already know that this is very small by Allen, Guinier, and Frigaud-Sudakoff proof. And we want to show that this one is also less than 8 epsilon over r. So the total sum will be less than 10 epsilon over r. So f will be very close to this function. And then what is this function? It's only a function of the first coordinate. This is a constant. It's not a function of any coordinate. And this is only a function of the first coordinate. So f is very close to a function that's only a function of the first coordinate. But the problem is that this is not really a 0-1 function. It can be any complex function. So to obtain that, we round this to this value, to this, to 0, 1. So we take 0 or 1, which one is small. It's very easy to see that it's only less than 4 times this one, and we know that this is less than 10 epsilon over r. So we get this. And this is only, this is a 0, 1 function, which is a function of the first coordinate. So that will prove the theorem. Okay, so our independent set is very close to an independent set that's only a function of the first coordinate. So I keep the goal here because we have to prove that. So we already know that f less than or equal to 1, that's the coordinates, that's the Fourier coefficient, Fourier expansion on the values of y that has less than or equal to 1 size, is close to f. We knew that. So I want to give values to all variables except x2. And since that we have that above, so there exist values delta I such that I get this g function that's only a function of x2 because I gave values to those other variables is close to 0-1 because f is Boolean, that function is close to Boolean, and this is a part of that function. So this is very close to 0-1. Okay, here you need some analysis. It's like one page you should have to write Minkowski inequality. Simple thing, but it's very simple. So intuitively, what happens is this. F is only a function of f can only get values 0 or 1. And that other one, f less than or equal to 1, it's close to f. So it gets values between close to 0 or close to 1. But what about the other one? It only has this function in that. So its variance is very small. It's the variance of g2 because the other one is a constant. And g2, the variance of g2 is so small that it cannot get the values both near 1 or 0. So it cannot be like this empty circle cannot get the values close to both of them. So it must be concentrated around one of them. So when it's concentrated around one of them, we can show that its variance must be small because we know that it's close to 0 or 1. So the variance is very small. But not very small. It's less than 4,000 epsilon over r. So here I just sketched the intuition, not the details. So when we got that, so we already know that these are decreasing, and we've proved this upper bound for g2. So we have this one. So take m to be the minimum value such that I can get this equation. There exists m because each of them is less than 4,000 epsilon over r. So m is not, this is, there is something in this sum. And since the sum is bounded and each one is bounded and each one is only a function of xi, gi is only a function of xi, when you take xi's randomly, this is, you can apply inequalities from martingales. And here we can apply Bennett's inequality because the total sum, the total variance is bounded and each are random variables. And we can prove that it's very concentrated. So by knowing this bound, this is a very bad bound, and applying that concentration theorem, we get this last bound, that it's very small. But here we assume that m is the minimum index which satisfies this. Okay, and we show that this is less than 8 epsilon over r. So m is equal to 2, because if m is not equal to 2, then we can add one more to this sum, because all of them are less than 4,000 epsilon. So, and when it's less than 8 epsilon, we can add one 4,000, and still we are less than 10 to the 4. So m is equal to 2, which showed our goal. We showed that all these numbers, this sum is very small, so we can ignore that. So that proves the theorem. One simple corollary and very nice corollary is that when r is equal to n, okay, so this is n, typo, we take kn to the n, then when we have this relation, the size of independent set very close to the size of the maximum independent set, I must be a subset of a maximum independent set, because take one, we know that I can be approximated by a maximum independent set. But if there is an element outside, if I has an element that's not inside this, which can be shown that it's very easy to show that almost 1 over e fraction of the elements of this one cannot be in I. But then it shows that the symmetric difference is very large, but it cannot happen by the theorem. So it's very good. It shows that when the size is very close to maximum, then you are a subset of a maximum independent set. But it requires that the graph is kn to the n. Or here we have some constant times n. It must be, r must be very large. So here, recently, Cameron and Koo, they studied the same problem for the permutations. So instead of this graph that each one has, can be, we can, in this graph, kn to the n, we can have the values that are equal. But what if it's a permutation? What if they are different? The n minus 1. They showed that we have the same situation here. If we fix only one element, then we take a maximum independent set. And every maximum independent set has this structure. Just fix one of them, we have n minus 1 factorial different elements in the independent set. And they conjectured that there is a C such that when your size is very close to the maximum independent set, you are very close, you are a subset of an independent set of size maximum. This is n minus factorial, minus 1 factorial again, sorry for that. So your conjecture is very similar to this corollary, but I don't know any way of applying this technique to this, because this is a permutation group and Fourier analysis is very messy on that. You know, maybe there is a way to reduce this one to this result, or maybe a direct attack is possible. Okay, thank you very much.